Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
So many Americans who were alive 75 years ago remember hearing those words just like you're hearing them right now over the radio. But as President Franklin D. Roosevelt addressed a stunned but determined America, some of the surviving victims of that attack on the Hawaiian island of Oahu were in extreme distress. This is Hometown Heroes, and we're talking today with one of the only five men still living who were on the battleship USS Arizona on the morning of December 7th, 1941. 94-year-old Nebraska native Don Stratton lives in Colorado Springs, Colorado now. Every once in a while, you'll catch him driving his vintage Chevy pickup, which is an immaculately maintained tribute to his ship and his shipmates. And as you'll see at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, a painting on the lid of that pickup bed allows Don to show you exactly where he was on the ship. And you will marvel at how he possibly could get down from there alive. We've heard some of that story, how after being engulfed in flames and burned over the majority of his body, he managed to climb down a rope hand over hand to the USS Vestal, how he spent the better part of a year recovering, receiving skin graft after skin graft at Mare Island Naval Hospital in California. His complete story is told in the new book, All the Gallant Men, which we'll talk more about in a little while. It's amazing that you even survived that morning, but to recover and go on to have the career that you had afterwards, it's really remarkable.
Well, that was just another thing that happened. I wanted to go back into the Navy, so I went back after I was home for about a year, and my whole left side healed up really much from the medical discharge. So I re-enlisted and went back in, and they put me on I went to boot camp again because it hadn't caught up on my shots and stuff, and I went to island there in the bay, and they put me aboard a destroyer, DD-406 USS Stack, STACK, and we headed for the South Pacific right away, and we were in on the invasion, the whole land in New Guinea and a couple of islands offshore there, and we went to Guadalcanal and picked up troops to put in the Philippines and the lady, and we were in the Battle of Leyte Gulf, and we were in the Battle of Luzon Gulf, and we led all the invasions in with the minesweeps and the destroyers protecting them, and finally Okinawa, and we were on pickup patrol 300 miles north of Okinawa between there and Japan, and for the kamikazes coming down, and let them know down below that they were on their way, and that was kind of hazardous. We lost five ships one night there, and one time there was over 100 ships and sunk and damaged in Karamret or Wise Man Cove at that time. And then they sent me back to the States and the war was over and I had a game.
And I understand that you lived that and that you've told your story many times. So that is, in a way, old hat to you. But you do understand how crazy that sounds to most people, right? That you were burned over the majority of your body. You still don't have any feeling in your fingers that you haven't had for 75 years. You're recovering for a year in the hospital. You've been medically discharged. But you sign up to go back, and you end up fighting the rest of the war. Why? Why was that so important to you?
Well, it's just one of those things that happens, I guess.
Was it?
Felt like maybe I should be there, but whatever happened. But that's the way it worked.
And the title of your book is All the Gallant Men, and you're honoring those who died December 7th and really the 406,000 Americans who died in the war. But it strikes me that just that action you took, I mean, you are the gallant man. Did you feel that you were doing something beyond what was asked of you?
No, the heroes were still out there.
Still on your ship.
Yeah.
What'd your parents think when you re-enlisted?
Well, actually, they didn't want me to go, but they said, if that's what you're made up your mind to do, it's your life to live.
Did you feel that you were avenging the deaths of your shipmates?
Not really. It was just the thing that surprise attacked and didn't get a chance to fight back too much, so I was still in the same predicament. I loved the Navy, and so I went back in.
Well, I'm sure you've heard a lot of people say a lot of things to you over the years, but I've interviewed close to 1,000 World War II veterans and many courageous, incredible men who blow me away with their stories. But just your story and what you just shared and your determination, that's really remarkable, sir.
Well, like I tell everybody had to be someplace.
Yeah.
And I was there.
And it's not like you took a Navy desk job somewhere. I mean,
no.
Statistically, the only thing more dangerous than being on a destroyer was being on a submarine.
I had to go through boot camp again the second time also, too. But
on the destroyer, and I can tell that you're proud of that ship.
That was like a 40-knot ship.
What were your duties on that destroyer?
Well, it was a gunner's mate. We were in charge. We had 4 or 5-inch guns and 2 dual 40-millimeter and about 8 probably 20-millimeters. And we had Y guns for the submarines, and we had torpedo tubes on board. So it was pretty well put together. And like I said, it was like 40 knots. That's long. That's moving across the water pretty fast for 1,500 tons of iron.
And what was your perspective in light of what you'd already been through? I mean, you've been through the most devastating day in American naval history.
Well, it was nothing. I don't know that I even thought about that. That was just past history, and it was already gone, and we're looking to the future.
Well, I guess what I wonder is, did you think, hey, I've already been through the worst, and I survived that, so nothing's going to get me? Did you think?
No, I just thought, this is where I belong, and this is where I volunteered to be, and we've got to be here till it's over.
And did you have some moments on that destroyer that you look back on now and say you were fortunate to survive those two?
Well, it was like I come out of the hatch one night at General Quarters, and an impulse charge went off right outside the hatch, throwing a depth charge overboard for submarine contact, and it kind of flashed back to me, and no, not again, you know.
Yeah.
But that was one of the things that happened, and like you said, everybody had to be someplace, and I was there.
What did it feel like when that war came to an end, having been where you were when it started?
Well, it felt great. I mean, everybody was hilarious, and I was in San Diego at a gunnery school there when that happened. And I just got home from back from 30-day leave, and I was ready to get discharged again. I got discharged in San Diego on December the 4th, 1945.
And went on. Maybe what I'm learning about you is this: you're just one that is used to living with danger, or you live on the wild side a little bit. What made you think that? Being
not necessarily. It's just all in a lifetime, like I said, to work with the divers. I worked offshore. I was a barge master on one of the offshore largest drilling ships afloat at one time. And we worked in Alaska. We worked in South America. We worked in Colombia. We worked in Kuwait. We worked all over.
You would dive on oil rigs.
Well, I was just a tender. I'd run the phones and sending all the equipment to the divers and getting them up and getting them into decompression chamber, run the chamber and getting them back out on deck. And that's what diving is considered. You get them in the water and you get them up and decompress them, get them out. Everything works out all right. We have a few difficulties every once in a while, and we come through all of them. We never did lose anybody. So I was on the phones to the divers, and I'd send all the equipment to them and talk to them and told them what to do and what not to do and when to come up and when to stop for decompression, what this and that and the other. But so.
And you did that for, what, 30, 40 years?
Well, I don't know exactly how long, a long time.
Did any of those guys know your story?
Oh, I think they all do. They knew that I was a survivor of the Arizona and all that, so we never did talk about it much.
You mentioned when you were on the stack, and that moment came, you flashed back to December 7th. Over these last 75 years, Is that something that happens every once in a while, that those images come flooding back to you?
Well, sometimes just certain aspects that happened makes you think back a little bit, but I don't think about it much anymore at all.
And you went all these years, and you talked about it plenty, but now the book. What made you want to or convinced you that you needed to get all this in print and have this story told?
Well, that was nothing to my doing. Some young lady read something about my surviving the Arizona and whatever, and they talked to her father, who was a writer. His name was Ken Geyer. And he came here for an interview, and we talked about this and that and other, and then he asked me questions, and I gave him answers, and he put it in the book, and this is the way it happened.
How do you feel about it? How do you feel about the book?
Well, I think it's great. I mean, I get calls every day about it. I just read your book, and I think it's one of the best books I ever read in my life. And I hope it helps somebody and a reminder of things that could happen.
Yeah, that was my question. Because there's going to be thousands and thousands and maybe even millions of people who end up reading your book. What do you want them to get out of it? What's the most important message you want them to glean?
Well, we have to be alert in the United States here, and we have problems with ISIS and all the other stuff that's going on, and it's just a reminder that every day you should think about things that could happen in this United States and things that shouldn't happen, and if you're alert, and as you should be, well, maybe it won't happen, but we have to be very vigilant. There's people in countries that would try to tear down our aspect of way of living, and we can't let that happen.
How many times have you been back to Pearl?
Well, quite a few times.
More than you can count, probably?
Well, I think the first time I went back was 25 years later, but I was there just last December for the 75th, but quite a few times in between.
What made the biggest impression on you there this last time, the 75th anniversary, where really the world's attention was on that memorial?
Well, it was just an idea that they entombed two sailors off the Arizona on there at the same time I was there, and the wall is there with all the casualties and whatever, and it just makes you think what could happen again and how vigilant we should be, and it's something that we should think about every day.
Well, and anybody who's hearing your story today, or anybody who picks up your book, All the Gallant Men, I think those people are probably going to think about it every day and certainly won't take it for granted. It's time to take another break, but if you'd like to order Mr. Stratton's book, I have links to it for you at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we heard him talk about being back at Pearl Harbor for the 75th anniversary. There are a couple other links online you really should check out. One is the special that PBS did with Mr. Stratton, letting him watch as a submersible camera captured images from inside the current-day USS Arizona in its rusty resting place just below the surface. And another link is to the keynote address at that 75th anniversary ceremony. A whale of a speech, and we're going to hear a brief excerpt from that when we come back for the rest of Don Stratton's story on Hometown Heroes right after this.